From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and sustainable living. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. The naturalist John Muir once said, "When one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it attached to the rest of the world." Well, a wonderful example of that tug upon nature was recently uncovered by researchers in Yellowstone National Park.
That's right, a linkage between wolves, elk, berries, and bears. How does that work? We'll find out when Bill Ripple from Oregon State University's Department of Forest Ecosystems joins us in the second half of the show to discuss how a healthy wolf population makes for happier bears.
That's right. And who doesn't want a happy bear? Seriously, you really want them to be happy. Anyway, that's the second half of the show. And in the first half, Nell and I will cover a number of news items, all fossil fuel related.
We'll start with a recent New York Times op-ed piece on the reality of climate change.
By four ex-EPA administrators, all Republican.
Interesting. And then to the latest on TransCanada, the company behind the XL pipeline, and their plans to build another pipeline, this one across the eastern half of Canada.
Right. And then an update on Exxon's Pegasus pipeline spill in Mayflower, Arkansas. You won't believe who they blame for the release of 200,000 gallons of Canadian crude.
Also, we talk about why the EPA recently fined a Chevron oil refinery right here in Salt Lake City, Utah, for violations to the Clean Air Act.
And finally, some thoughts on Park City Council's recent resolution supporting the use of reusable bags.
Of course, you can always join in on today's discussion by posting your questions or your comments to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
It's This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters.
Park City Restore turns your donation of gently used home furnishings, construction materials, and furniture into affordable housing through Habitat for Humanity in Summit and Wasatch Counties. Check habitat-utah.org for a list of items accepted at the Restore during business hours, Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 6. Restore is located in Silver Summit at 6280 Silver Creek Drive. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
The top international cycling teams, many who competed in this year's Tour de France, will travel to Utah to compete in the 2013 Tour of Utah. Recognized as America's toughest professional cycling stage race, teams will return to Park City the weekend of August 10th and 11th. From the red rocks of southern Utah to the epic stages of the Wasatch Range, all of the action culminates on Park City's historic Main Street for the final stage, Sunday, August 11th. For more information on the event, stages, activities, and how to volunteer, go to tourofutah.com or parkcity.org. Park City Municipal Corporation, a nonprofit organization.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond with Republic Services, your recycling and garbage services provider, and a proud supporter of KPCW. Recycling pickup in Summit County is now every other week. Remember, recycling materials go in your larger blue or brown bin. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, along with Nell Larson. We're here every week. Every week. Only on KPCW.
Only in Park City.
There you go. Well done. So, Nell, we got in the second half of the show, we have a researcher coming on to talk about his paper regarding relationships between
wolves and bears. And it's one of the first papers to look at the interaction between those two really big, you know, predator species. So that's exciting. And it was just released.
Just that.
Breaking news.
Yes. And it's a really interesting relationship and the linkages there talk about in the environmental and ecosystems. So, but before that, we're going to spend, the first half of the show talking about a bunch of news items. And we're going to run through these as quickly as we can because we got a lot of information to share.
That's right.
All right. So the first one, we kind of said in the intro, they're all fossil fuel related. And this is the big, you know,
In one way or another.
This was a really interesting op-ed piece in the New York Times back on August 1st. It was titled "A Republican Case for Climate Action." I won't go through the whole piece, but, you know, the thrust of the of the piece was that A, climate change is occurring, B, we're playing a major role in that change, and C, mm-hmm. something needs to be done, and that those—
And quickly.
And quickly, exactly. And that Republicans in Congress need to start to put down their skepticism and downright denial of this issue and actually go along with the president's climate action plan. I'll give you one quote. Here it is in the piece. There is no longer any credible scientific debate about the basic facts. Our world continues to warm, with the last decade the hottest in modern records, and the deep ocean warming faster than the Earth's atmosphere. Sea level was rising. Arctic sea ice is melting years faster than projected. And then further, quote, rather than argue against his proposals, the president's proposals, our leaders in Congress should endorse the president's climate action plan and start the overdue debate about what bigger steps are needed and how to achieve them domestically and internationally. So again, the thrust of the thing is that this is a problem, this is an issue, and yeah. Congress needs to start doing something about it. But here's the thing. It's written by four ex-EPA administrators, all of them Republicans. Okay, William Ruckelshaus, Lee Thomas, who served under, I believe, both under the Reagan administration. Ruckelshaus served under both Nixon and Reagan's administration. Bill Riley, William Riley, who was with, I think, Bush 1 and mm-hmm. Christine Todd Whitman under Bush
2. So the thing that kind of stuck with me about this is was a really simple statement that they made. And yeah. they said, if we could articulate one framework for successful governance, perhaps it should be this. When confronted by a problem, deal with it. Look at the facts, cut through the extraneous, devise a workable solution and get it done. And that seems like such a simple thing to say, but somehow that hasn't happened with relation to climate issues,
No. You
know, in any way. And so I thought, you know, to hear these four people saying this is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. And that's why I urge our listeners to go online to Time's website. It's an August 1st op-ed piece entitled, well, now I'm trying to we've got so many pages now.
Entitled what? What was
entitled,
that entitled?
A Republican Case for Climate Action. Okay. So that's item number one.
That's right. Hey, check it off the list.
Yes. Let's move on to the
second
one.
Are we on schedule?
Yeah, so far. TransCanada's pipeline heading east.
Interesting. Okay.
So TransCanada, they're the company that is trying to bring us the XL pipeline, which would send Canadian oil sands from Alberta south through the Midwest to terminating in areas of Houston or so.
But as we've covered on the show, that has run into some stumbling blocks and
yes.
some barriers.
Barriers of different sorts, and it's still still under review.
Right.
Right now, it seems like a decision from the State Department, who actually makes the final call on this, with the assistance from the White House, so it's effectively the president's decision, won't come until sometime this fall. So, TransCanada...
And this is, what, the sixth time the decision has been pushed back?
I think their feet are sore from kicking that can down the road. But in any case, that decision is coming up. And so in the meantime, TransCanada is saying that they're planning to build a similar pipeline of basically the same size, actually a little bigger, that would carry over a million barrels of Canadian crude oil or Canadian tar sands from Alberta to the refineries in eastern Canada, in Quebec City and St. John's in New Brunswick. They say that this is a pipeline that is in addition to the XL pipeline. Instead of. So
we don't know if we believe that.
Right. They may just be hedging their bets that
right.
XL is denied. But in any case, the Canadian environmental groups have said this is not going to happen. You know, or you're up against a major fight if you're going to try to build a pipeline through, well, essentially central and eastern Canada. But that's TransCanada's latest efforts to get their Canadian oil sands out on the market, because they've already been told that they can't go west.
Right.
They're having trouble going south.
Quite a bit of trouble.
And they're going to have as much trouble going east. So
even within their own country, nobody wants the pipeline running through their backyard, the wetlands and the...
and you know what? That kind of segues to the next part of the story. Because why? Because, you know, pipelines fail sometimes for one reason or another. And when a pipeline carrying Canadian oil sands fails, it can be a big problem. Canadian oil sands are very heavy. They can be very chemically aggressive. And they can be very, very difficult to clean up. And we saw an example of that back in March when a pipeline failed in a small town called Mayflower, Arkansas, literally in a neighborhood.
Right. In a backyard.
Yes.
He went running down the street in front of, you know, cutting off the neighbor's houses from one side to the other.
Right down the gutter, of course, into the storm drains.
Right. Into the streams.
And then in the wetlands and then into a nearby lake. Exxon did what they could to address this as quickly as possible. But some 200,000 gallons of Canadian oil sands were released within about an hour. It only took about an hour. Because these lines run, as we learned, high pressures, high flow rates, and high temperatures.
High temperatures.
They have to run at high temperatures because this heavy oil is so viscous. So they need to keep it warm. So that happened in March. Yeah. And then it kind of fell, of course.
Yeah, and I mean, it was everywhere on the news, and we were seeing these videos of it, and we were hearing about, you know, the relocated neighbors and the... the drama in this tiny little town.
Exactly. And the effort was to have the place cleaned up as quickly as possible so the neighbors, homeowners, could be back in their homes because they were evacuated for several weeks, about 20 homes in this cul-de-sac neighborhood. Nice neighborhood cul-de-sac.
Nice little neighborhood.
As I did a little research just this past week, a couple things. They are back in their homes. The area is still being cleaned up. So Exxon is still out there excavating the impacted soil, trying to deal with any impacted groundwater. More importantly, they're trying to deal with the ongoing impacts to the surface water, the local wetlands, and some surface water associated with the a portion of this large lake where there's still visible sheens showing up.
And there's a lot of attention being given to this lake because this is a recreational hotspot. There's a lot of fishing. People want a boat. And that can't happen.
Right.
When
so there's still booms out to protect this cove area and the wetlands. So the cleanup, it continues almost 5 months into this spill, since this spill occurred. The people are back in their homes, but many homeowners are concerned because they still can smell. There's still odors associated with this event. And some homeowners are complaining that their children, particularly their children, are suffering from respiratory effects. They have allergy or allergic type responses. They're having trouble, rashes and other issues that they've never had, they've never seen before.
Right.
And they feel that this residual oils that are in the ground in the area is the cause for it because they still smell it. Basically.
And this is something we've kind of seen before when we, you know, covered health impacts from the Gulf oil spill. It was similar things. And it's hard to peg any specific one thing to, oh, this is from the vapors in the air. This is from the oil on the beach.
Yes.
But there's this huge, you know, all of a sudden people are seeing these impacts and they personally feel sure that this is where it's coming from.
Right.
So it's a tough issue.
So the point is still ongoing and we'll still track it for you right here on This Green Earth.
Of course.
Only on This Green Earth. Now, the segue to there is like, okay, so Exxon did their what they call their root cause analysis. Why did this happen? The pipeline basically failed. I mean, it literally opened up.
It was something like a 20-foot long rupture.
20 feet long, almost 2 inches wide at its widest point, but it just kind of opened up. Exxon has determined that the reason this happened was that the pipe manufacturer is to blame. A company by the name of Youngstown Sheet and Tube manufactured the pipe And when did they manufacture this bike? Back in 1950.
60 years ago.
Yeah, 60, almost 70 years ago. And they did their metallurgical analysis and determined that there was some strains in the pipe that shouldn't have been there. And therefore, it was the pipe's fault, not the fact that Exxon was running a different type, a heavier type of oil through the line, not the fact that Exxon had decided to increase the flow rates through the line by almost 50% when they took over ownership of the line in 2009. And,
Minor details there.
Higher pressures and higher temperatures. So
all things that are going to cause huge stress on a pipe that's 60 years old.
Exactly. And the pipe's 60
right.
years old.
Right.
So that's Exxon's root cause analysis and determination. And by the way, Youngstown Sheet and Tubing is out of business, so it's okay.
It's very convenient. We can drag their name through the dirt.
That's the latest on the Mayflower Canadian Oil Sands release, thanks to Exxon. Let's move on to another company,
yeah.
another oil company,
and this
Chevron.
Gets local. This gets
We're
local
getting local.
Here.
We're getting more and more local.
That's right.
This one is Chevron. Chevron to pay a $384,000 penalty and improve emission controls to resolve Clean Air Act violations at a Salt Lake City refinery, notably their refinery in Salt Lake City. An inspection by both the EPA and the state of Utah found that Chevron made changes to what's called their fluid catalytic cracker unit. Those are the tall towers. When you drive by a refinery, you see these tall, thin silo-like towers. That's the catalytic cracker units, where the raw oil goes in and then it gets separated out into its different components, gasoline, diesel, naphtha, benzene, all the goodies that are inside crude oil gets separated out. Okay. But those units were releasing nitrogen oxide, and nitrogen oxide, among other things, contributes to ground-level ozone, acid rain, and it can also irritate the lungs and lower resistance to respiratory illness.
So when we might add that ozone has been an ongoing problem in Salt Lake in the summer as well as the winter.
Exactly.
So this is not, this is an important target.
Yes. So they were fined.
That's right.
Says you
okay.
Do
so they were, first of all, required to install pollution controls on three engines at the refinery, which would reduce nitrogen oxide emissions by an estimated 50 tons a year, which is a significant amount.
It's a lot.
And then in addition, they are required to spend $100,000 to support the purchase of four new compressed natural gas school buses for the Jordan School District in Salt Lake County.
Right.
And the operation of those buses will conserve an estimated 6,300 gallons of diesel fuel each year, in addition to lowering particulate matter around these kids. So they have a $384,000 penalty.
Yeah. And they have to buy some school buses, which
exactly.
I hope they won't be able to go on their website and promote.
And promote. Exactly.
You know, as part of the period. Look at us.
Goodwill. They're generous with our community.
Compressed natural gas. It's not even our compressed natural gas. We're letting them burn someone else's fuel, not our diesel.
So, foreign natural gas.
Yes. So anyway, so there's some issues associated with Chevron. All right, we got one more story.
Yeah.
We are a few more
on
minutes.
Target, on time.
And now we're going to bring this kind of fossil fuel related stories kind of local in the sense of reusable plastic bags.
That's right.
Plastic bags are manufactured from... actually, it's interesting. Plastic bags are manufactured by gas. Ethylene is a gas that either comes from oil or natural gas. So when people say plastic bags are made from oil, that's not necessarily true. It's the gases that are extracted out of about – yeah. So ethylene comes out of oil, and it comes out – it can be in natural gas. But anyway – that's the gas that's used to make polyethylene bags.
There you go.
Got it?
Fact
All
of
right.
the day.
Ethane, yes. So anyway, it's a fossil fuel related product.
Right. And there's been a lot of discussion around this bag topic in Park City and Summit County for years. You know, there's been movements to ban the plastic bag here, which, you know, it turns out we can't really do under Utah law. And there's been efforts to encourage people to use alternatives or use paper, encourage the grocery stores to provide one thing or another. But this is moving forward yet again. And I think one thing that it's important to note is that actually the carbon footprint of a plastic bag is actually less than the carbon footprint of a paper bag.
Oh.
So we don't want to just push people using paper bags. We want reusable.
Reusable. That's the third alternative.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And so, you know, the thing with, I think, one of the biggest concerns with the plastic bags is just the fact that they're everywhere. They litter. They blow away.
Sure.
You know, we they find them all over our open space. It's,
do you? You find them out in swamp?
I do. I found them on the preserve all the time. It's definitely the number one A piece of litter that's found. I mean, out
really?
in the middle of the preserve. So, inevitably they're sort of like ripping to shreds and you know, just
and it takes years
clogging
and years
things
and
up.
Years
they get in the streams
to break down.
Exactly. They're not going anywhere fast.
Okay.
So they're a big problem.
All right. And so the city, Park City Council passed a resolution back last Thursday, the 25th, that basically, you know, basically it doesn't have a lot of teeth to it, but it's a resolution that says we support the use or we discourage the use of plastic bags and promote reusable grocery bags. Okay.
All right.
That's fine. And in addition, the city has agreed to provide $6,000 to Recycle Utah for continued education and outreach as far as is promoting reusable Park City grocery bags. And I think they're going to be developing a Park City
a bag that people want
specific,
to use.
But, okay. But here's the thing. If you don't think that plastic bags mean much, like you're saying now, they're out there. They're a big problem with respect to litter. Otherwise, they end up in the landfill where they will stay there for decades and decades because they don't.
Right.
It takes a while.
Okay. Unless, of course, people recycle them or reuse them.
All right. So how many bags are we talking about that we could potentially save, not use?
And I'd like to say before we look at these numbers, you think, okay, we just want to encourage our community to use more reusable bags. We just want to encourage visitors. Like, how big of a difference is that really going to make?
Right. And so I did some numbers. There's three supermarkets in town. Two in town.
Within the city.
One in Kimball Junction that provide plastic bags. Whole Foods, I believe, does not. Okay, so there doesn't. So three supermarkets. I was told that on average they accommodate about 1,000 customers a day throughout the year. You know, winter and summer high seasons are even more. But assuming 1,000 customers per day, that's 3,000 total customers at those three stores. Let's just say 10%, and that's the number that one of the supermarket managers gave me. He said, anecdotally, about 10% of their customers have reusable bags. So that's 300 customers that have reusable bags. And he says they save three plastic bags per customer. So that's 900 bags, plastic bags per day that are not being taken out of that store. Those three stores.
Which is already a big number.
Run the numbers through the year. That's 315,000 plastic bags that are not coming out of just those three stores.
Right.
You know,
that doesn't count all of the other grocery stores in Summit County.
Or other stores, dry goods stores, or, you know, other businesses that would provide a plastic bag. So that's a big number. And that's just 10% use. So if we can up that a few more percentages, that's tens of thousands of more plastic bags. So,
if not hundreds.
Hundreds
of
exactly.
Thousands,
so the point here is that, you know, think about a reusable bag and the value of that is really amazing.
It's kind of a little bit inspiring, Chris,
inspiring to
hear those numbers. You think actually maybe I am making a difference by bringing my reusable plastic bags.
Exactly. And maybe we'll inspire a few people.
That's right.
Yeah. Numbers don't lie like that.
Right.
You know, that's the facts.
That's right.
So, okay. That's it. That's it for our news items.
Enough of listening to us talk. We'll have a guest on the second half of the show, Bill Ripple, who will talk about the effects of bringing wolves back to Yellowstone and how that's made for a happier, healthier bear population in the park.
happy bears.
That's right. That's what we want to see.
Exactly. It's this green earth. And it's all continues right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch in Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from checking and savings accounts to business lending. We have Heber Valley Bank in Midway and Heber, and Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch in Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts, news topics, controversies, and concepts of sustainability. I'm not Nell Larson. She's not Chris Cherniak, but we're both here. And time to move on to our next topic.
That's right.
Okay.
So, all right, having some minor technical difficulties over here. But on the phone with us this morning is Bill Ripple. He comes to us from Oregon State University's Department of Forest Ecosystems. And he's here to talk about some of the interesting ecosystem dynamics that are happening in Yellowstone Park right now. So, Bill, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this field of study and how long you've been looking at these kinds of issues.
Well, I think I originally got started working in Yellowstone in 1997, and I wasn't at all interested in the wolves at that point. I was interested in the aspen trees, and aspen trees were declining in the park. And it was a mystery as to what was happening with the trees, and the scientists really didn't know why the aspen were on this major decline. So my grad student and I went out to the park, and we cored the trees with these devices that allowed us to drill into the side of the aspen trees, and we extracted these cores, and we counted the rings. So the tree rings told us that aspen stopped regenerating in the first part of the 20th century. And what's interesting is that what we found is that that's about the same time that wolves were killed off by the federal government. So at that point, we developed a hypothesis that wolves, the top predator, affected the aspen trees, and I've been working there ever since. So this linkage is we just simply connected the dots. Wolves eat their main prey, which are the elk. The elk eat the young tree sprouts. Therefore, the wolves affect the tree sprouts.
Right. So in effect, the absence of wolves increased populations of elk, who then increase consumption of aspen and other food sources, which then reduce the population or the health and welfare of the aspen groves.
Correct.
Okay.
So give us, I guess now, give us sort of the thumbnail sketch of the study that you just completed and published.
Okay, so we just completed this study of the linkages between wolves and grizzly bears. So if we continue on with this same scenario, we had this hunch that wolves affect the elk again, their main prey, and the elk this time eat on these shrubs. So they browse the shrubs, and these same shrubs produce berries. So so we have the wolf to the elk to the berry-producing shrubs, and it just happens that the grizzly bear also used these same shrubs by eating the berries off of them. So what we were working on is the presence or absence of wolves affecting what the grizzly bear actually eats, how much in terms of berries that the grizzlies consume.
So I think I read that, you know, the grizzlies like doubled their intake of berries in the month of August or something along those lines.
Right.
It was a big change, right?
Yes. It's about double.
So what other kinds of impacts are you seeing? You know, this increase in the eating of berries by bears is one thing, but it seems like there are a series of other impacts that were also mentioned in your paper.
Well, yeah, good question. So what we're finding, not only with wolves in Yellowstone, but large predators from around the world, is that they're considered apex predators, and they sit on top, at the very top of the food web. And what we're finding is that they have these incredible effects on the entire ecosystem. So in the example of the wolves in Yellowstone, once we document how they're affecting their prey and the vegetation that their prey eats, then these positive benefits to the plants translate into improved biodiversity and affect many different animals. For example, or should I give you a couple examples on that?
Sure. Yeah.
One thing would be that the willow are growing taller in some places in Yellowstone Park now since wolves have returned. And these willow are used by a number of different animals. For example, beavers have increased since wolves have returned. So the beaver eat the willow, and they also use the willow plants to build their dams along the streams. And so with more beaver, then we have more ponding based on these dams, and that's good for waterfall. The more willow that we have along the stream banks, the more shade we have cast on the stream, which is good for fish because they like the cool waters in the shade of the stream.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also these taller willow are also good for different types of songbirds that use them for habitat.
Mm-hmm.
It's creatures as small as insects can benefit from more vegetation for their habitat and food needs. So those are some examples of the far-reaching effects of a top predator. We call this process cascading ecological effects. And it's quite interesting to see. It's just a matter of connecting the dots, as I said.
So it's interesting because it's the impact of these apex predators comes not just from directly, you know, the number of animals they're eating or a population reduction, but also behavioral changes, right?
Sure, yeah. So there's two types of effects of a predator. One is called mortality effects, and that's the obvious one, where they just cause mortality on their prey. But another interesting effect is called behavioral effects. And some people refer to this as the ecology of fear. And the fear that they instill in their prey when they're present on the landscape can be as large, the effects of that can be as large or larger than the mortality effects. So whenever we have predator on a landscape, we can look to see what these behavioral effects might be, how the fear factor might play into the situation.
I like that term, the fear factor applied to ecology.
Hey, going back to the grizzly bear, we talked about the relationship between elks and among other things, the berry population. How important are berries to grizzly bears' diet?
Well, generally speaking, they can be very important. The fruit in a grizzly bear's diet is typically important in most places where grizzly bears are found, like in Canada, in Yukon, in Alaska. It's important in the late summer and the early fall. So the berries have a lot of sugar in them, and these carbohydrates, when consumed in great quantities, allow the bears to gain weight in the fall before hibernation. So in many places, the bears, like in late summer, over half of their diet will be in berries. So they love the berries, and it's traditionally been known that that's the case. And they will spend all day long just feeding on these berry patches.
Wow,
that's a huge amount of berries.
Oh yeah,
half of their diet.
Yeah.
Who knew something so big and strong? It's scary. Just eats berries.
That's right. So if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Professor Bill Ripple from Oregon State University, and we're talking about the interactions between wolves and grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park. So, Bill, let's talk a little bit about one of the things we read in your article is that the increases in berry production in the park may also provide a buffer against other ecosystem shifts, like maybe climate change. Can you explain how that works?
Well, yes. For example, the climate with climate change, we have issues with whitebark pine seed production. So the seeds from the whitebark pine cones can be an important source of nutrition for the grizzly bears in the late summer. And climate change is putting pressure on those whitebark pine trees, and the trees are declining. So we think that if there can be an increase in a berry consumption at the same time of year, it may help buffer the grizzly bears from the impacts of climate change.
Got it. So there's also sort of precedent for high levels of, like elk or other ungulates, herbivory causing problems for bears. Has this, where else has this happened? Where else has this been seen?
Where else has what been seen? What do you?
The high levels of herbivory, of ungulate herbivory.
Okay, so where else have we seen high levels of ungulate herbivory?
Yes, causing problems for bears.
Okay, with the bear thing. Okay, let me think. We write about a couple of cases in our paper, and one is in the southwest United States in the very early 1900s. When there was an introduction of a lot of livestock onto the range, and the grizzly bear was still there, and the overgrazing by the livestock caused a loss of plant foods like berries for the grizzly bear, and eventually the bears started getting really hungry at that time and did start killing livestock, and then at that point, the grizzly bear became extinct in the American Southwest. So that's a historical account. Then there is another thing that happened more recently, and this is on the St. Lawrence Seaway in eastern North America. There's an island. Its name is Anacostia Island, mm-hmm. and there were black bears living on the island, but at some point in the 20th century, white-tailed deer were introduced to the island, and these deer did not have any wolves as their natural predator there. There weren't any wolves on the island, so they started eating themselves out of house and home, and they ate down the berry-producing shrubs so much that the shrubs did not produce hardly any berries. And the black bear on the island went extinct because of the deer eating their food source.
That's interesting. So you talked about how healthy wolf populations, you know, affect elk, will affect, say, willows. How does a healthy bear population, what influence does a healthy bear population have on the ecosystem? Is there a ripple effect there?
Well, bears are top predators also. So yeah. The bears are omnivores. They eat both meat and plants. And they have a role to play in predation. So, for example, the bears, they prey on juvenile deer and elk as soon as they're born. So the newborns are prey for the bears. So what we call this a predator guild when the bears and the wolves are both present in the ecosystem. So this is how it was historically in most parts of North America. Bears coexisted with wolves, and together they're part of this large predator guild, and together their effects they affect their prey and keep the prey in check. So. Even though the wolf is considered the flagstone species, the main predator here, the bears have an important supporting role as top predators in these systems, especially helping keep these browsers in check by their predation on the newborns.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about, like, the mechanics, the logistics of your study. So you go to Yellowstone Park. How do you discover, you know, exactly what the bears are eating? Explain how that all works.
Okay. So, we had several different components of this current study. But one thing we did was to go right to the bear diet portion of the study. We looked at the historical bear diet, and we found in the archives, we found where the government collected data on what the bears were consuming during the period before wolves were reintroduced to the park in the 1990s. So the process involves collecting so people go out into the field and they pick up and collect the bear scat in the field, and then they take it
like
to the laboratory.
Oh.
What's that?
It sounds like a fun job.
Yes. So they take it to the laboratory and clean it up, and then dissect it and find out what the composition of the food was for these bears. So that's a long process, but we were able to assemble the data from the period before wolves, where thousands of these scats were collected and analyzed. Hmm. So we sorted through all those data, and then our co-authors from Washington State University were out collecting new scats in 2007 and 2008 and 9. And they had hundreds of them during those 3 years. that we were able to use. So we simply compared how much fruit was eaten by the bears before the wolves versus after the wolves, and we found that there was an increase.
That's really interesting. So you actually have pre-wolf bear scat and post-wolf
bear scat. Right, we didn't have the actual bear scat, but we had the data summaries from that.
Overall, Bill, are there any surprises in this research? I mean, there's so much information you probably mined out of this. There's several papers, it sounds like, you can get out of this. Any surprises, though?
Well, I think, I'm continuing to be surprised with these far-reaching effects. One thing is to realize the effects of predators on prey or the plants that the prey eat. But now we are seeing these likely effects from one predator, one top predator, to another top predator. So I think that is just it's just amazing to think how these rippling effects might affect the ecosystem.
Huh. Yeah, there's lateral effects far as kind of vertical effects like you were talking about.
Correct. But
yeah, that's interesting.
So what's next in your research? Where are you heading with your results from this project?
Well, we're going to continue to monitor vegetation in the park. So I've been going out there every year, and we monitor the plants to see how they're coming along since wolf reintroduction. And that's really important because the plants, if they can flourish, the ecosystem can flourish. All the animals, in one way or another, depend on plants, either for habitat or for food. And so we're going to continue on with that. And I'm also collaborating with scientists from around the world. You know, Yellowstone and the wolf story is just one predator story, but scientists from all over are finding these fascinating, far-reaching effects of top predators in other regions. For example, lions in Africa, their effects, lynx in Europe, sharks off of the coast of Australia. It's quite interesting. So collaborating with a wider group and comparing notes with them is what we're doing now also.
So what are the implications of your research and similar, predator research on management strategies for these species? Are the federal agencies taking these kinds of things into account?
Hmm. Well, yes, they're taking notice and starting to consider these types of things. But, this type of research is relatively new in terms of wildlife and ecosystem management. So it's going to take time for policymakers to take everything into account, and we still need to do more research. But I think one of the basic lessons is that now that the research is starting to show these ecological effects of predators, that it's obvious that policymakers should start to think about far-reaching effects of the animals that they're managing, like the predators. For example, in the past, policymakers would just consider, well, what makes sense for how many predators that we have? We don't want them to go extinct, so we're just managing for their existence on the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing, to look at the animal itself. This is the one species. But what we're saying is that now policymakers should start to think about and consider the entire ecosystem and entire groups of species that may be affected by one species that they're managing. So I think the basic lesson is to think a little bit more holistically in terms of managing ecosystems and the animals.
Right. But, Bill, you talked about the fear factor amongst animals. Well, there's a fear factor associated with wolves that us humans have that we have to get rid of. And that's a whole separate area of research and policy
Right, yes, issues. And I work as an ecologist, and so this is the point where I hand it off to the to the policy researchers and the social scientists, and let them do their thing. So, yeah, there are definitely, this brings up many different questions in terms of the public policy on how to manage the animals, definitely.
Yeah.
So, Bill, we have to wrap up in the next couple of minutes, but where can people go to learn more about your research?
Well,
we have a website. That's a good question. Perfect.
Yeah. Okay.
So do you want me to recite the name of the
sure.
website?
Sure.
That'd be great.
Okay. So it's www.cof.orst.edu
okay.
/ Cascade. CASCADES. So
perfect. We will post that to our Facebook page in case anybody is having trouble scribbling that down in the car.
Right.
Yes, and you can also Google my name or the word trophic cascades, TROPHIC cascades, and you can get this information that way too.
Okay.
Fantastic.
And there's a number of news articles that have been out too. So you can just search on the news.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Great. Well, that was Bill Ripple joining us from the Oregon State University Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Hey, let's take one last break for some underwriters, and we'll be back to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond at Republic Services, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Gray is for garbage. Those four words will help you remember the current waste and recycling program. Your blue or brown bin is for recyclables. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch. We're proud to support KPCW. Grand Valley Bank is pleased to announce the Deer Valley Wednesday Night Community Concert Series through August 28th with Utah-based musicians. For schedules, deervalley.com or 435-615-2265. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
It's time to wrap things up on This Green Earth. Great conversation again. Thanks to Bill Ripple from Oregon State University, all about linkages between wolves and bears and elks and as Nell's
and
I were talking,
willows and willows beavers.
And beavers. And once you get the beavers, everything changes. All right,
absolutely everything.
Yeah. But it's all good, and that's the whole point. It's all good
that's
for
right.
the ecosystem,
down to the water cycle we were discussing
exactly.
on the break.
So, but let's most importantly thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible without. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanities, Restore.
Rocky Mountain Power.
San Francisco Design.
And Prudential Utah Real Estate.
Of course, you can always learn more about our show and past shows by joining us at our Facebook page, KPCW
right.
This Green Earth.
You can email us with comments or questions as well at thisgreenearthradio@gmail.com.
And finally, don't forget to check out the KPCW's new website where mm-hmm. all our shows are also archived. It's This Green Earth. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next week. Here's NPR News. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.